Hi, I'm Surabhi. I work at the intersection of tech, media, and gender, and I'm also a podcast nerd.
I am Mosetti, and I support organizations create space for engagement, impact, and growth. We are part of the RNW Media team.
And this is a podcast where we make sense of media from the ground up.
We explore public interest media in a changing world. From challenges like trust deficit, disinformation, censorship, and sustainability,
to innovations in AI, media funding, and online safety, and helping media makers make their work impactful.
You'll hear from journalists, from thinkers, from organizations who are working in the front lines of media development.
Because media isn't just about the headlines, it's also influencing us and shaping our societies.
This is Media Actually.
We thought we'd start this season by getting a bit provocative. And so we're asking the question, what comes to your mind when you hear the words public interest media?
So yeah, public interest, I think it's maybe a bit more vague, like what is in the interest of the public. So I don't know.
It's providing verifiable information to the public. So basically it's the production of verified information, which is in the best interest of the public.
I'm not sure, but I guess something balanced, representing all viewpoints in a fair way.
For me, public interest journalism is contextual, it's not sensationalized. For me, public interest journalism is also independent and reader-based. And it doesn't fear amplifying marginalized voices.
So without knowing what it is, I should answer it?
Yeah.
Okay. I would imagine that it's media that is for the public interest, obviously. Defined, and public interest in this case is defined by the people who are doing it. So what that actually means, I don't know.
What comes to mind is clarity. What comes to mind is bottom up. What comes to mind is collaboration among journalists here.
Well, as you can see, the awareness of public interest media really varies a lot, which leads me to think, do we really need public interest media to begin with?
And why does it matter? Mm. Why should we be worried about the state of public interest media today globally?
We have a guest in the studio today. Our guest today is an award-winning independent journalist and researcher who was previously the political editor at the Polis Project, a hybrid journalism and research organization based in New York.
He has also been an assistant editor at The Caravan, a magazine of long-form journalism on politics and culture based in New Delhi, India.
Before that, he was actually a practicing criminal lawyer in Delhi. This year, he will begin his PhD at SOAS University of London.
Harsha John, welcome to the podcast.
Welcome.
Hello.
We are so excited to have you here.
I'm excited and nervous.
Why are you not? You shall end this by just being excited.
Let's do it.
Let's talk about media. Maybe let me ask the first question and let me ask you, give us your take. I mean, we've heard from people out there talking about what they think is public interest media, but what do you think public interest media is?
I'll be honest, before we started this podcast, before I was invited to it, I had not heard of the term before. I really sort of broadly just thought of it as journalism, and then I did some general Googling to try and understand what it was and what it sort of refers to. And really, from my understanding, it seems to be that journalism needed a PR makeover. So they came up with the term public interest media, because what it seems to refer to is a lot of things that are just what I would consider good journalism. You know, stories that concern people, stories that are of social or public political importance, stories that hold power to account, stories that, you know, reflect accurate fact-checking in a way that the public trusts it, all of which to me seem like just good journalistic practices. I think one thing that I've come across, which public interest media is a bit broader than journalism, is insofar as it's not necessarily your traditional newsrooms only that are covered under it. Mm. Right now we have a lot of individuals who, you know, will start their own little local news coverage and put it up on YouTube, things like that. So those independent individual newsmakers or content creators or whatever the term may be can get covered under it, which I suppose is a good thing. Because otherwise, journalism conventionally has had criticisms of being quite gatekeepers of knowledge and what is allowed and not allowed to be shared to the public, and this sort of democratizes that a bit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, what makes it even more relevant in today's world, right? Like, the politics is shifting. We have AI revolution happening as we talk. The world political order is evolving and changing, and people feel that they don't have control over their lives anymore. In such a context, why is it important that we still have public interest journalism or public interest media?
I mean, I suppose for all those reasons specifically, because it's quite a depressing world and we have a live stream genocide every day. And to try and understand what is important, to sift fact from fiction, to sort of contextualize issues and topics, or even tools like AI, sort of to better understand how we can access it and how we should use it. Ooh, I think public interest media can and does play quite a critical role in helping it, I think. Yeah.
And I mean, this connects also to, I suppose, the challenges then. I think a lot of us who work in the media development space have been thinking about how does trust in media, not only has it diminished over time, but how do we now restore it? How do we, re-strengthen the trust in our media institutions, but also public institutions more broadly? And of course, what you mentioned in this age of where a genocide is being live streamed, and we only have so much attention spans to look at content that truly matters. What are some challenges that we are facing in terms of public interest journalism?
I think the challenges we're facing is sort of why we've come to the point of needing that PR makeover from calling it journalism. I mean, so you have general, like you say, news trust. Then the trust in the news has decreased over the past decade. There's general news avoidance. Funding for independent media is struggling, which is why, media's trying to do different things like shifting to alternative business practices, models, trying to navigate over-reliance on video. Yeah, I mean, I suppose all of these is the challenges to how that people are trying, that the media is trying to confront.
Well, I mean, I think I'm very interested in what you said, and some people might find it a bit controversial about the PR makeover.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk a bit more about that? Like, also as an independent journalist yourself, and who has worked on, in public interest journalism for long, was it warranted that we needed a PR makeover? And what do you make of this PR makeover? And who is in charge of this? Who is controlling this narrative?
I think everyone's trying to desperately figure that out. Why do we need the PR makeover? I think, there are multiple reasons. We can sort of try and figure it out one at a time. One is the distrust in news, right? Mm-hmm. Then it's about trying to understand why does that distrust exist, which again, there's not going to be any one smoking gun that explains it. There's a lot of things that I think over the past 10, 20 years have come together to sort of create this situation. You have the rise of social media and the way the platforms are used. There's a reliance on that, and I think with that reliance comes news media. I mean, again, two things. One is the reliance on social media makes people's one attention span over time reduced in a way that there is not the patience and commitment to deal with journalism. Two, the algorithms themselves are designed to provoke outrage or sort of deal with the extremes of emotions. And those then will be the news stories that get sent to the top of your feed. And because of that, like the different reasons for the distrust then I think sort of play into each other. Because when you look at that, the Institute, Reuters Institute Digital News Report, they've been studying this for a while. And they've shown how there are these different reasons that play into each other. So one is this, then there's the fact that people just are tired. People are exhausted with the doom and gloom of news. But part of that, I imagine, is because the doom and gloom of news is all they're confronted with as well.
I guess for me, let me ask you then, what changes? Because, okay, there's all these things, the challenge. So then let's change, or let's give it a PR makeover and stop calling it journalism and call it public interest media. But then what changes? Because all these things could also still be very much
completely
in public interest media, no?
Yeah, I think so. I think this is... that's why I was saying I'm surprised by the term. I feel like people have come up with the term to be like, listen, journalism, there's no money in journalism anymore. Nobody's funding independent journalism. So media organizations needed to call it something else to be able to get funding. And the funding organizations needed to be call it something else to justify the funding. Because at a time when public trust in journalism is declining, you can't go and say, we're funding journalism. You have to say, we're funding
public
the public interest media. We're publishing the good stuff. We're public, you know, we're funding the interesting stuff, or we're funding the honest stuff. Whereas institutionally, I don't think there's any difference between the two. I think it'll be the same institutions that claim to be journalism that also will claim. I think it'll be your same NYT, Guardian, everyone. The same mainstream organizations will claim to be public interest media as well. I don't think they will sort of distance themselves or dissociate themselves from it.
But then earlier you also mentioned, you know, with the rise of the term public interest media, there's also more people who are coming into the fold, the individual people.
Correct.
So I'm also keen to talk about the people who are at the edge. I mean, if you think about it as a Venn diagram, there's the journalism people, but then there's, or rather journalistic practices is what is in the middle. And then there's the old school institutions, as you say, and then this new kind of people.
Right.
So I am interested to hear more about this new sort of fork. How does that look like for them stepping into the world of media or stepping into the world of journalism, especially given that many of them don't have journalistic backgrounds, don't have that, you know, ethical sense, they've not gone to school for it and all that. So how does that process of stepping into the world of media and journalism look like?
And if I may just add to that, I think, you know, I know Indian context very well in terms of the news. And I mean, as a news consumer myself, there's this prevalent question in public discourse right now. Are content creators journalists, right? We see a lot of podcasters interviewing relevant public figures, but they are not necessarily doing the work a journalist would do, right? So, but large amount of people are actually consuming that information as something that is akin to news. So I think what Sam is also trying to say and what we are trying to get at is there's this new group of people as content creators, social media influencers that have taken up the space of providing news to people online How do you feel about that as a journalist who has been in this field for a while?
Yeah. I think it's both. It can be very important and useful, but it can also be quite dangerous. So a lot of the reason why, especially in the Indian context, but I imagine globally, a lot of the reason why you have these independent journalists come up and sort of start their own YouTube channels or things like that is because a lot of mainstream organizations were not or cannot always be trusted apart because they might be serving corporate interests or government interests, and they sort of, you will have independent reporters who want to do the work, want to sort of tell the stories that they wish they could tell, but are unable to because of the legacy corporate controlled media institutions that want to serve particular agendas. In India, most mainstream organizations will not be critical of the government, will not be critical of the RSS, the far right organizations at the helm. So insofar as that, there is a great value to it. The danger, I think, becomes when I mentioned that there's that journalists sort of play that role of gatekeeping, right? Mm. That gatekeeping has its problems, but that gatekeeping also has its functions because there are some fundamental journalistic ethics or practices that may not necessarily be adhered to or even known by influencers or content creators. So, things like double verification of facts, making sure that, there are two sources before you put anything out there. Any sort of opinion or analysis should be based on fact as well. Just because something is an opinion does not mean it's a license to spread misinformation. Yeah. I mean, reporting sort of practices in terms of how do you respect your sources, whom can you put on TV, on screens, on video. But yeah, just basically some sort of basic reporting ethics and journalistic practices, which, because people are not trained in, they might not follow. Alternatively, even because the influencers themselves might be funded by particular ad agencies or products or things like that. So this is also why, I mean, partly it still comes down to the same issues. The fact that those sort of agenda-driven or corporate-driven practices that have led to distrust of legacy media, that is equally, I mean, independent or content creators are all public interest media is equally vulnerable to it, I think.
Right. And so if we go back to challenges then, and you shared quite a few of them, we also want to now pay attention to what are some solutions out there. So I'm just wondering also if you can, from your own experiences of both having worked at the Caravan and the Polis project, how did you ensure that public interest issues that you were working on were reaching out to your audiences that it was intended for, right? And what solutions have helped you to keep that work going and keep it sustainable in the long term?
Keeping it sustainable is difficult, to be honest, because the funding for it is right now is quite thin. There's this annual journalism festival called Perugia. That happens in Perugia. I didn't go this year, but a few of my friends went, and they were telling me it was basically just a scramble for funding. It was freelancers trying to find organizations who will fund them, and it was organizations trying to find funders who will fund them. And funders were like three people saying, listen, we can't do any more funding. So keeping it sustainable is tough. That's why a lot of people are sort of shifting to trying to shift to subscription models, some successfully, some unsuccessfully. That's one thing Caravan did quite successfully. But similarly, Polis is also trying to turn to subscription models. That's sort of one of the main ways I think organizations have managed to. And I think essential to that is basically just doing good journalism. Like, and that's even in the digital news reports, that's what you'll see across their surveys. That's what people say about how do we increase trust in news. Do better reporting, do ground reporting, don't have an over dependence on opinion. We have way too much opinion as it is. Have transparency in terms of journalistic practices. There's a great piece that earlier in my career in Caravan, we'd let, it is about this, the practice of sources. There's this journalist in India, in one of India's Indian newspapers, National Security Beat, called Praveen Swamy, and the article's called Praveen Swamy and Legacy of Sources Journalism, where basically he would just be entrenched within the sort of security establishment, have whatever, and then claim to have exclusive stories that were attributed to just sources, and journalism does require you to sometimes keep people anonymous, but there are again basic practices you can have to, you know, have, be a little transparent. So, I mean, simple things like have a policy, like, I mean, this is the policy that we had at Caravan. It's what I instilled at Polis Project when I was editor there, that sources can only be anonymous if you have, if it affects their lives or livelihood. If it's just because they want to be, then you have to find another source. You tell the reporter you have to find another source for that story. So, but this is, I mean, just an example of what I mean by transparency, that you can be transparent to your readers as to why is the person, why is a source remaining anonymous. So instead of saying a source said, say, you know, a senior official in whatever ministry said and refused to disclose their identity because they were out of threats, fear of threats. So do better reporting, be more transparent.
And do you think transparency also around media ownership and who's funding
absolutely.
Is important
absolutely.
To audiences?
Yeah.
I particularly liked when you spoke around business models, because I think this is going to be one of the podcast episodes that we do in this series, where we try to look at how people are innovating. And I want to just dig deep a little bit into your experience, having had experience a bit in the Global South and in the Global North. And when you look at the process of how these innovations are changing, including this PR makeover of journalism into public interest media, how do you see the differences between these two geographical locations that are so different, of course, geographically, but also funding-wise?
To be honest, the efforts in that regard seem sort of similar. I mean, I should say Polis Project is Global North insofar as it's based in New York, but the coverage, its sort of focus areas is largely still Global South as well. I mean, it was largely focused on South Asia, but I mean, it did expand to other parts of Global South. But in terms of what the efforts were, so one, like I said, there's just two, moving to a subscription model. Two, there was sort of moving to newsletters and things like that. The general sense seemed to be based, I think, on, you know, media studies, market research, different variety of things, that readers like the personal touch of sort of knowing who is the person writing this, a little bit about them, reading something in a bit more less formal tone, less journalistic tone. So I think newsletters is something that addressed that. And that I've seen across the board. I mean, that's there in Indian organizations, that's there all over, you know, Western publications. Everyone's moving, has a lot more newsletters coming out, has their Substack that people want to, they want people to subscribe to.
And a personal anecdote on that, I remember I was a subscriber of The Wire back in India, and I think right around COVID, they did this whole process of like actually reaching out to subscribers and having calls with them to understand what are the issues that matter to U.S. citizens that we should be reporting on. And that felt really, really good because you're like, yeah, this media organization does care about what I want to read or watch or listen to. And like you said, the personable aspect of it made it so much better than just being one of the numbers that they're trying to follow up on. So, yeah.
I mean, it's like, while that is true, and while, you know, we should definitely, you know, ask readers what they want published and sort of what they should cover on, I think at the end of the day, you also just have to follow your own editorial instinct on, like, what makes a good story and have a sense of why is this story important? Why does this story need to be told? Has this story been told before? Am I just sort of repeating the story for the purpose of creating content? But what I mean to say is that so the viewers might not necessarily know
what they want,
or whether what they want is already out there. Because, and that's sort of where it becomes a journalist and an editor's role to find those stories that are important and tell them well. And in my experience, as long as you do that, as long as you find the important story that has not been told and you tell it well and you report it well, you will find the viewers. The viewers and the readers will come if your story is engaging enough and important enough.
Well, cool. So we focused on funding, which obviously is the biggest, one of the biggest challenges. We talked a bit about trust. I wanted to also think about the changing landscape of digital media itself. You know, as you mentioned, it's all about grabbing attention in the online space. And of course, now it's increasingly being determined by algorithms on social media. And with AI generated content, it's becoming even harder to sort of understand what's fake, what's not. How does public interest journalism and media deal with this challenge?
I don't know if public interest media does manage to cut through the noise. From what I can tell right now, people are relying on AI so that AI cuts through the noise. Because that's, I mean, again, I keep going back to the digital news report because that's the sort of largest survey of news consumption that I know. But that's the latest 2025 report talked about that. It talked about how people are in this year, in the past year, have shown an increase in depending on AI to be like, hey, tell me the top 10 stories, give me the summary, where because... And that's what was one really interesting part of that report was they talked about how till now, whenever news organizations have thought about personalizing news and how do I make it interesting to a person, they've thought about it in terms of the substance. What is the substance that might be interesting to individual people? But what the survey found is that even when people use AI, they are personalizing it in form. So they are asking it to be sort of give it in bullet points or make it in simple form or translate it to this language. So it's AI is being used in that form to cut through the clutter. I mean, of course, you know, generative AI is its own monster that has all sorts of concerns that we have to be cautious about. But I don't know if right now public interest media is managing to cut through the clutter. I suppose we're trying.
What can be done more, do you think?
I wish I had like a silver bullet answer. I feel like I keep coming back to just be better.
Just do better.
Yeah, just do better journalism. Be, you know, have fact checkers, have... do better reporting. And then on the other hand, that's from the journalistic institution side, but you need from the
audience,
not the audience, the social media platform, you need and social media platform and the state, I suppose, you need content moderation. I mean, as scary as, you know, there's that balance between moderation and free speech, but I think it's necessary. It's where you're either in terms of misinformation, disinformation, just sort of effective mechanisms and resources to flag that and stop that, and in terms of the way these algorithms work and what news is prioritized, what is not, what is pushed to what age groups it's pushed to, what communities it's pushed. I think we need some sort of moderation regulation over that, because that's part of what's leading to all the noise right now. So maybe that's another way to go about it, but I don't really have an answer.
I mean, we have to keep innovating and keep seeing how the trends go. What happens if we do not have good journalism / public interest media in the world? If we lose the funding, if all of these things that we are afraid to happen, and we just do not have means to sustain good journalism, what happens then?
I think it can be quite dangerous, because I think part of the reason why we've seen increasing distrust in the media is also because we have populist leaders who've recognized the power and how to weaponize social media and disinformation. I mean, of course, that's existed before, but the scale and accessibility of it now is really something else. So I think if we don't have that public interest media or journalism that's sort of doing its work well, that really just gives them an immense amount of power to do that a lot more. So you'll just have authoritarians to be a lot more successful and find it a lot easier. You'll have corporations getting away with everything. I mean, I think essentially public interest media's, or at least I have what I would call a healthy distrust of rich and powerful people. And if it did not exist, you would just have the rich and the powerful get more rich and rich, more powerful at the expense of everyone who...
I mean, after that very gloomy scenario that you said, I do want to ask... what are some public interest stories that have mattered to you over the last few years, and organizations that you follow that you believe and you have trust in the work they do?
One story that I read yesterday, because it came out just day before, it's from this Dutch organization, SOMO, which is Center for Research on Multinational Corporations. It's a rough translation, but it's SOMO, which I suppose also... sort of comes within our discussion today, because it seems to be, I think, more of a research organization and not a typical classic journalism organization, but I suppose it still comes under public interest media. But they've published one piece which looks at the corporate funding into Israel. They found it's quite sort of fascinating. The Netherlands is the largest funder, or is sending the most amount of money into Israel, 49 million, billion, more than even the US. The US, I think, was at, one sec, I have the figure. Yeah, the US was 30, so significantly more than the US. It looks at sort of Dutch companies that are doing it. It cites the UN Special Rapporteur Francesca Albanese's latest report, which is about how we've moved into an economy, sort of studies the economy of the genocide, so to speak, and the different sort of countries and organizations funding it. But I think what matters then is not any particular organization, but the sort of work they're doing. So just to sort of answer your second part of the question in terms of what organizations do I trust, I don't think I'll trust any organization blindly. I think you just sort of look at what their work is, who their sources are, how they've reported it, how they've attributed it, And I mean, I don't know how useful this is to sort of put out there, because I don't know if your average reader is going to be thinking of all that. But I suppose that's sort of the point of having media literacy right now, and maybe you need it more. There will be organizations I will go to regularly, but I will go to those organizations to read, to get a sort of first sense of it. And then if there's something that's interesting, I will read more into it, because I think I will not necessarily be instinctively trustful of any one particular place, except if that work itself, you know, instinctively I can see that it's well researched, it's got a interesting access or a variety of sources. So for instance, so for this one, they show what data they're relying on, which, you know, they link to it so you can verify it yourself if you want. They show the reports they're relying on, and then I use that to go and read Francesca Albanese's latest report, which is, yeah, I mean, quite distressing, really. Yeah, that's, I mean, Somo's latest report on the economy of genocide in Gaza. That's a sad, depressing, but important piece that I read recently.
But I think it made me think of something very important. Of course, transparency seems to be the through line right here. That really does matter in terms of building trust. But the other thing you mentioned, are average audiences doing the kind of work that you are saying in terms of like going back to the links and actual sources and really assessing whether this is true or false? And which makes me wonder, public interest journalism or media can also not last without audience, right? Like, you need audiences that are
engaged,
media literate. They're engaged. They care about these issues.
Yeah. I mean, it's true. And also, to be honest, I have felt the doom and gloom of media myself too. So I don't really blame anyone for tuning out and wanting to not be engaged on it, because it is depressing. Do audiences put in that sort of effort? Probably not. And I don't know if we can really expect them to. You can expect publications to be better about it. I think what you can expect audiences to do, even if not do all that sort of work of cross-checking all the sources, because I mean, that, you know, I also did because I'm interested in it. And if you're interested in something, audiences might. But what audiences can do is have some sort of, I don't know, healthy skepticism, I suppose, of
healthy distrust. I am taking that one now.
Yeah, sort of just to read how many sources does the story cite? Is the source named? Do they know, you know, are they identified as an expert in whatever they're talking about? So just basically just some sort of critical reading, I suppose. I mean, I think that much you can...
It's a bare minimum.
Yeah.
I think actually that's very important. One line that I was reading yesterday that I found very profound is that AIs hallucinate, but humans do it too. So sometimes, I mean, you might find a good article and you think, oh, there might be good sources here, but then the sources might also be very much hallucinated.
Mm.
So that sort of healthy distrust or healthy skepticism is really important to keep as audiences, to ensure that we are engaged and ensure that we get the right information at the end of the day.
Yeah, I suppose. But then the problem becomes if we are, you know, I'm sorry, I don't mean to go in the opposite direction.
Please do.
But if we're talking about news organizations already having, the public already having a distrust of the media, that's where the problem becomes, where if you then distrust everything. So I don't really know how you... How do I tell people, no, you can trust this guy, but you can't trust that guy?
I mean, at least we can agree on the bare minimum has to be that critical level of thinking as a reader or as a listener of a story. You have to apply your brain a little bit and be like, okay, this I believe, this I don't believe. And there's very many factors that go into that I think even media itself cannot necessarily control, but yeah, we're just doing our best.
I mean, I don't think anyone has time to kind of dig into a story. Like, part of the reason why I follow certain media brands is because I trust that they're doing the work they need to do to put out a story, right? Mm-hmm. So while still being skeptical, it's also difficult to then start investigating every story that has been put out and be like, hey, is this really true? I don't have the time or bandwidth to do that. Like, I would rather say, okay, this is from this news media brand that I really trust. They have consistency over time, and I trust what they're putting out. Of course, once in a while, they make mistakes, but then do they also are transparent about those mistakes and they put out a disclaimer or they put out, apologizing, corrections. Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, it's.
But then you say it rightly because you have done the work of understanding or getting to understand this news outlet. I like their pieces because of how they frame their stories, how they do their things, how they, cite all their sources and all these things. So you have done the work. I think for me, it's about that audiences need to also do their work to see who do they trust most. And then they can build trust on certain brands based off of that.
I suppose it's a tough balance to strike.
It is a tough line to walk. Like many things that public interest media deals with, and like many of the topics that we'll be dealing with in this podcast.
So should we wrap up?
Yes.
So before we let you go, Arshu, we have a question that we would like to ask all of our guests. We have a series called The Digital Media Shakers, where we profile people who are influencing or shaping the digital media landscape. And if you had to share something with our audiences or someone who is changing or influencing the digital media space that people should be paying attention to, who is that someone or something?
I mean, it's easy for me to also just shout out my first organization, The Caravan, because they do a lot of great, very important work. They are also, I believe, trying to deal with this current situation of how to engage readers. They've just started a new video podcast. So yeah, go check out The Caravan. There's another British organization that I really like called The Tortoise. They do a lot of interesting podcasts, as well as a newsletter that I really like. But I think broadly, both these publications, what they do well is the sort of thing that we've been discussing, which is just doing good journalism that puts in the work, finds important stories, interesting stories that are not being told, and does them well.
Do good journalism.
That's a wrap. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Wow, that was a lot to process. Very interesting conversations. And I think the challenges that Arshu mentioned around funding, around algorithmic censorship, around this tension between audience first versus editorial decision making around what stories matter, I think that really stood out to me. And one thing that he really mentioned that I think was the through line of the episode was that we need to get back to the basics and do good journalism.
Yeah.
What did you think about it?
I mean, some of the things that I'm taking home, first of all, he started with a very provocative sort of sense of statement, which is, are we just rebranding journalism into public interest media?
Right.
So we need to understand that at the core of it, it's good journalism that matters, number one. But number two, I also liked his comparison about Global South and Global North. At the end of the day, all of us in media, we are fighting the same battles. Be it as it may, the people with resources and the people without, we are all fighting the same battles. And I particularly liked when he said that we need to have a healthy distrust to certain things and certain people and certain outlets and all that we read online.
Yeah. And we would love to hear from you as well. What did you make of this episode? Were there reflections, ideas, thoughts that you had? Please leave that in the comments. We would love to hear your feedback.
Thank you so much for tuning in. In our upcoming episodes, we'll continue to unpack public interest media, especially the intersection with funding, big tech, and making it an inclusive, safe, and reliable space.
And don't forget to follow us on our socials and find us wherever you watch or listen to your podcast. This podcast is produced by R&W Media and made possible with funding from Right Here, Right Now 2 program.
Many thanks to our in-house podcasting team and our media production company, Media Matters.